Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I am Daniel Emery Price, and I'm joined by Chad Bird. Chad, how you doing?
I'm great. I'm great. How about you, Dan?
I'm good, man.
Ready to rock and roll?
I'm ready. I am ready, man. Where are we at?
We are just about at the end of, well, we're actually just about the end of Genesis, but specifically we're just about at the end of chapter 47. Now, I'm going to say this so that I have obligated myself to do this. I'm binding myself to this promise, all right? So today, in this 40 minutes, we're going to cover what's left of 47 and 48. And then we're going to cover 49 and 50 on the next 40 minutes.
Audacious.
You know what that means?
That's audacious.
I know. It's a bold assertion, but I'm gonna stick with it. So we're gonna cover what's left of 47 and 48 this episode, 49 and 50 the next episode, and you know what that means?
That means we're moving on to Exodus.
All right. Yeah. That's and I tell you, if you think Genesis has been an awesome story to sink ourselves into, just wait till we get to Exodus. I mean, it talk about a theological, Christological gold mine. That's what Exodus is. So I can't wait to dive into all the good stuff there.
It also ends us at a nice round number, because this is episode 59. That will be episode 60. And here we go. 60 episodes of Genesis.
I'll be there. 60. 60 episodes of Genesis. Can't beat that.
No. All right. Well, then we better get started on this if we're gonna make you a man of your word.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess we better get rolling. Just a very, very brief recap. The first part of chapter 47 is when Joseph brings his brothers in front of Pharaoh, and then he brings his elderly father in front of Pharaoh. You'll remember that Jacob blesses Pharaoh prior to the conversation and after the conversation, and kind of summarizes his life as a life of few and unpleasant years. At that point, he was 130 years old, and he and all of his clan had just arrived in the land of Egypt, settled in the region of Goshen, and there they acquired some property, and they waited for the famine to end, and began to sink roots into the soil of a foreign land. So that's and then we have a brief summary of how Joseph, through various kinds of taxation, brought more and more of Egypt under Pharaoh's control. So that's kind of where we left off last time. And we're going to pick up here with verse 27 of chapter 47. And it's kind of an interesting way that you have in verse 27 almost a preview of the same kind of language we're going to hear when we get to the book of Exodus in about 3 weeks, because it says, Israel lived in the land of Egypt in Goshen, and they acquired property in it and were fruitful and became very numerous. Now, that idea of being fruitful and numerous not only harkens back to the first couple chapters of Genesis and the command of God for Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply. So it looks backwards, but it also looks forward, because as we're going to read in the opening verses of chapter 1 in Exodus, it says the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. So you kind of have this verse in chapter 47 looking back to creation and looking forward to how the generations to come are going to be multiplying even more in the land of Egypt, which is in fulfillment of God's promise that they would do well, that God would do well for them even in this foreign land. So they have land, they have a lot of kids, and we're told after that that Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. And so he's gonna reach his 147th year. Now, I think I pointed this out in the last episode, but I'll point it out again. just as a kind of a nice reminder of the way that God works. So Jacob had Joseph with him the first 17 years of Joseph's life. And then he went through that long, dark, troubling period when he thought his son was dead. Then finally, he has him back. And he arrives in Egypt when he's 130. He dies when he's 147. So he also has Joseph with him for the last 17 years of his life. So kind of a nice balance there between blessing and then a time of suffering and deprivation and grief, followed then by 17 years of what we assume was joy, having his son close to him once more. The last couple of chapters, the end of this chapter and then the following two chapters, 48 and 49, really all take place around kind of, you can, around the deathbed, if you will, of Jacob. So he's 147 years old. He's very near death, but he's got a lot to say. In fact, you could almost say he says more in these last couple chapters than he does in all the previous chapters of his story. And he's, first of all, here at the end of 47, going to give instructions to Joseph about what to do with his body after he dies. And then in the next chapter, he's going to bestow a blessing upon Joseph's two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And then in chapter 49, he's going to gather together all of his sons, and he's going to more or less forecast their future for them. He's going to pronounce a blessing or a semi-blessing, or in some cases, the opposite of a blessing upon his 12 sons. So you can kind of picture this as an expanding circle of people that Jacob talks to in these chapters. First of all, he's going to talk just to Joseph. And then in the next chapter, he's going to talk to Joseph and Manasseh and Ephraim. And then in chapter 49, he's going to talk to all of his sons at once. So let's first of all quickly cover what he says just to Joseph. So he's about to die, and he calls Joseph to him, says that he wants Joseph to deal with him in kindness and faithfulness by not burying him in Egypt. And not only does he make Joseph promise, but we also have this kind of awkward physicality to the promise as well. You may remember way back when Abraham sent his servant to find a wife for his son, that he made that servant promise. And when he made the servant promise, he had him touch his thigh, which, as we talked about, was a euphemism for his genitals, kind of a very strange strange part of their culture, but that's what they did. Well, here we kind of have the same thing happening again. So Jacob is not only going to make Joseph swear, but he says, "Put your hand under my thigh." Now that could be, I guess, literally a thigh, or it could be a euphemism once more. But either way, we have Joseph not only promising in his words, but as it were, adding the touch to that as well. So he puts his hand on his father, and his father continues by saying, "When I lie down with my fathers, I want you to carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place." And Joseph responds by saying, "I will do as you've said." And then his dad makes him swear. He says, "Swear to me." And so he swore to him. Now, we might ask, what's the big deal? I mean, who cares if Jacob is buried in Egypt or if he was buried in the Holy Land, or, you know, what difference does it make? Well, it made a huge deal of difference to the people of the Old Testament, because in particular to the Israelites, because the only ground that God had sanctified for them, made holy for them, and that he had promised to give to them and to their descendants after them, was, of course, the Holy Land. And the land itself was emblematic of the mercy of God. It was almost like the land was infused with the presence with the gracious presence of the God who had redeemed them, who had called them, who had chosen them as his own. So Israel or Jacob wants to be buried there because that's his home. That's not just his home, but that's the place that God has chosen for him. So his very burial spot is to be an indication of God's chosen land. So his body rests, awaiting the eventual resurrection, where God had chosen to give the gift of his grace and mercy to his people.
I wonder if this, so is this a move? This is a move that you make when you want someone to make a promise and you don't want them to forget this promise.
Pretty unforgettable.
Yes. So it's, if you make someone promise in this way and then they try to tell you, oh, dude, I forgot. You're like, you forgot when I made you touch my stuff and swear an oath to me? Like, I don't think you forgot that. No one forgets that. When I was a super old man and I made you and I made that and it went down like that, like you don't.
Nobody forgets that. Yeah, you know there are certain things that you cannot unremember, and that's one of them.
That's it.
This has never happened to me, but if it did, I guarantee you, I would never, no matter how old and feeble and forgetful I became, I would not forget that.
No, I'm positive this has never happened to me. That's the whole point. Yeah, right. I don't think that's ever happened to me. No, I know for sure that hasn't happened to me. That's the whole point. Because something like this is seared in your memory.
This goes well beyond a handshake.
Yes. Yes. This is amped up.
Yeah. So, I suppose this was Jacob's way of making sure. This was the patriarchal way, you know, of making sure that the descendants didn't forget their promises. But, you know, there are certain, as much as I love the Old Testament, and everybody who's listening to this certainly knows that, there are certain things about the Old Testament that I'm glad are not still practiced among us. This being one of them. So anyway, that's the way the chapter winds up. But Jacob, it's not as if Jacob then breathes his last and dies after having Joseph promise to take his body back into the Holy Land. No, he's not done yet. He's still got a lot to say. So why don't we move on? That's the end of chapter 47. Now we're at the chapter, beginning of chapter 48, and the audience around Jacob, this old dying man, is going to increase. Now we're going to have not only his son Joseph, but we're going to have Joseph's two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Now, everybody will have to kind of go back in their memory a few chapters to remember about Manasseh and Ephraim. When Joseph got out of prison and was exalted to the right hand of Pharaoh, one of the things that Pharaoh did for him was he gave him a wife. She was the daughter of one of the Egyptian priests named Potipharah. So this priest had a daughter named Asenath, and she became the wife of Joseph. And they together had two sons. And the firstborn, and this is significant, the order matters. The firstborn was Manasseh, and then the secondborn was Ephraim. So we have to keep that in mind because the order of the birth is what this chapter is all about. So Joseph and his wife had two sons. And if they had any more after these, then we're not told about that. As far as we know, they only had these two sons. So here's what happens. It says after these things, so after this little conversation between Joseph and his dad, Joseph found out that his father was sick. And a parenthesis here, by the way, I always like to note these things. This is the first time in the Old Testament that we have a mention of someone becoming ill. One of these days, I'd like to do a study about the first time things were mentioned in the Bible, because we have a lot of that in the book of Genesis. And this is the first time we have mention of illness or sickness. That's not to say, of course, that it didn't exist, but this is the first mention of that. So Jacob is sick. And so Joseph goes to visit him. Evidently, they they were in the same area, but they weren't like living under the same roof. So Jacob at his place, Joseph probably was back, had his own residence, palace type structure, wherever he lived. So Joseph goes to visit his ailing father, but he doesn't go alone. He takes his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, with him. They tell Jacob, look, your son Joseph has come to you. And Jacob, who's called Israel in this portion of the story, Israel is not only sick, but he's bedbound. He's so ill that he's stuck in bed. In fact, we're told in the previous section we just looked at that even then, when he talked to Joseph, he was in bed. So he's in bad shape. I mean, he's right near his death, and so he's bedbound at this point. When Jacob hears that his son has come, he gathers all the strength that he can muster, and he sits up in bed so that he can talk to his son, because he has something very important that he's about to say and to do for Joseph. So Joseph comes in, Jacob's sitting up in his bed, and first of all, he has a little conversation about his past. This is actually very fitting. He's at the end of his life, and he wants to recollect for Joseph what God has done for him throughout his 147 years. So he references something that happened to him in the past. He says, God Almighty, which in the Hebrew is El Shaddai, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. And here's what he said. God said, behold, I will make you fruitful and numerous, and I will make you a company of peoples, and will give this land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession. So you kind of got a couple things going on here. You have God promising Jacob not only is he going to have a lot of descendants, but he's also going to have the land, which is, of course, the two main blessings that we have promised Abraham and then to Isaac and then to Jacob. You get the land, and you got the blessing of numerous offspring. So you got kids, and you got land. So God made this promise to Jacob. But then he's not finished. He's referenced this promise that God made to him. And now we have a very shocking, unexpected adoption that takes place. So he says to Joseph, when I was back in the Holy Land before I came to Egypt, God made this promise to me saying that I was going to have a land, I was going to have offspring. And then he switches. After he quotes God, he says, and now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came in Egypt, those two sons are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are. Now, I don't know if Joseph had any inkling of what was about to take place. To our knowledge, he did not. I mean, all he knew was dad was sick, dad was old, and it was time to go see him, and so he brought his two sons along. But in the middle of this conversation that Jacob has with Joseph, he reveals that there's going to be a change of parentage, if you will. He is going to adopt Joseph's two sons as his own. So the grandfather adopting the grandsons. But not only is he going to this isn't just kind of a hey, I'm sort of claiming these as mine, because there's a whole lot more involved with this than simply that. If they are Jacob's sons, then they are co-heirs with the other sons of Jacob. So they are being elevated to being the recipients of the blessing that Jacob is going to give to his son. So they are no longer grandsons. They are now sons. And so they are equal with Dan and with Asher and with Naphtali and with Simeon and with Levi and with all the other sons of Jacob. In fact, as we'll see as the story goes on, what's really happening here is that Ephraim and Manasseh are taking together, are taking the place of the firstborn son of Jacob. Now you remember, and I might be getting a little bit ahead of myself, so I might have to circle back here, but I'll go ahead and say it now. You remember that in the natural order, Reuben was Jacob's firstborn. And then you had Simeon, and then you had Levi, and then finally you had Judah as the fourth one. Now Reuben is the one who was disqualified from inheriting the blessing of the firstborn because he defiled his father's bed, as it says. He slept with one of the co-wives of his dad and thus disqualified himself. Simeon and Levi were next, the second and third, and they disqualified themselves when they attacked the city of Shechem after the rape of their sister and, you know, slaughtered all the male inhabitants of Shechem, which we've talked about. So the first three, Reuben and Simeon and Levi, are out. So what's happening here is that instead of the blessing of the firstborn falling upon Reuben or falling upon Simeon or upon Levi, the blessing of the firstborn is actually going to pass to Joseph in the person of his two sons. Now, I want to make sure that this is clear. So the firstborn is actually going to be two people, if you will. It's Joseph, but represented in his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. So it's really an amazing twist that's taking place here, because Jacob is disregarding the order of the birth, and instead he's choosing Joseph, and he's kind of splitting up or pulling together the blessing of the firstborn, and he's giving it to these two sons of Joseph.
It seems as though part of this is there's some legitimizing of Joseph's children who are obviously not full Hebrew, as it were. So it wasn't as though Joseph went and found, you know, we've seen over and over again, you know, you got, you know, go find a wife from our people, you know, so you gotta go down and hang out with Laban and go get Rachel and Leah and all this kind of stuff, right?
Right.
And they're sort of there. So even before, you know, Israel's sort of a nation, they're still sort of your people. You know, there's still the people that are like you and the people that aren't exactly like you. And down in Egypt, those people would qualify as not exactly like you, which is exactly what Joseph marries into. And so you have to wonder if some of this also, I mean, besides the other things that we'll get into, but some of this also is you sort of have the patriarch here sort of legitimizing Joseph's family, lest there be any talk of, well, you know, Joseph's got, you know, kind of, it's kind of jacked up. I mean, he's got kind of this like half-breed family going on. And that, of course, serves as like this wonderful picture of the grafting in of Gentiles and that sort of thing as well. Adoption into the chosen family of God.
You know, that's a great point. It's actually I had not even considered that, but I think it's a great insight, because, as you say, there's a long history here of making sure that the wives of the patriarch are from the family.
Yeah,
and then we have a huge change here because well, first of all, Joseph was the only Hebrew down there, at least the only one we know about. So there wasn't, you know, a bunch of Hebrew women that could have been chosen for his wife. So and not only is his wife from Egypt, but she is, I mean, she's right from a family of the religious, the priesthood of Egypt. So I can well imagine that there would have been some talk. Yeah, well, yeah, look at Joseph's wife, right? She's not only Egyptian, but her dad is an Egyptian priest. So this completely not only legitimizes these sons of Joseph as full Hebrew, fully part of the family, fully part of the blessing, but it even elevates them to a higher status than their uncles were. So they are now given, by virtue of the patriarch's blessing, the affirmation of full status in in the chosen family.
Right, yeah, because this isn't just as simple as, hey, you need to treat them like they're part of our family, the way that like I treat people that marry into my family, or you treat people that marry your family. They're brought into the covenant. I mean, that's this legitimizing them is saying that promise that was made to Abraham applies to them.
Yes, exactly.
Which is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it removes all doubt and invests them with this honor that before this point we never would have dreamed was going to happen. By the way, if anyone is listening to this and wants to read a little bit more about how Joseph becomes the one in his sons who receives the firstborn, you just take a look at 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, where it goes over that. It says that the birthright was given to the sons of Joseph. So that's instead of Reuben or instead of one of the other sons, it was given to the sons of Joseph. That's 1 Chronicles 5, 1 and 2. So the grandfather, the patriarch, Jacob, has now adopted the sons of Joseph. And not only has he adopted them, he's given them a blessing. And not only has given them a blessing, but he has elevated them to firstborn status. So he says that just as Reuben and Simeon are my sons, now Ephraim and Manasseh are my sons as well. And then he goes on to say, but you know what? If you have more children after these, and like I said earlier, we have no biblical evidence that Joseph did, but he said, if you have any offspring after this, they'll be yours. So they're legally going to be Joseph's. But they'd simply be called by the names of their brothers. So they would receive the inheritance of their brothers, but they would legally remain Joseph's children. So the only adoption that's taking place is of these first two, Manasseh and Ephraim. And then he has a brief recollection of Joseph's mother, of Rachel. He says that, you know, when he came from his exile to Padan Aram, that Rachel died to his sorrow in the land of Canaan on the journey, and he buried her there. Now this seventh verse kind of seems out of place. It just kind of doesn't really fit the narrative. But I think what's going on here is that the reason that Jacob recollects the death of his first wife is because, in some ways, what he's just done in the adoption of Joseph's son is an honor to her. Remember that she had trouble having kids. She finally had Joseph, and then she had a second son, Benjamin, but she died in childbirth with Benjamin. So she wanted more children, but not only did she have trouble having the first two, but of course she died having her second one. And I suspect that one of the things that Jacob is doing here is honoring her memory by actually kind of giving her two more sons, if you will. He's by adopting Ephraim and Manasseh, he's kind of adding two more to Rachel's progeny. So you could, because of this adoption, you could really say that Rachel has four sons. And she had two in her lifetime. She had Joseph and Benjamin. And then she had two kind of granted to her in memory after her death, Manasseh and Ephraim. So I think that's probably why he recalls her death at this point in the conversation. So that's the first seven verses. Now we kind of have a switch here that goes on. We become much more kind of I guess you'd say formal in the conversation that follows, because we're about to have the actual blessing pronounced upon these two sons. And there's another surprise awaiting us here too. So kind of picture the scene here. You've got Jacob in bed. He's ill. You've got Joseph standing there with his two sons. And Israel says, he saw Joseph's sons and he says, who are these? So this is kind of formal, you know. He knows who they are, but who are these, he says. And Joseph responds, they are my sons whom God has given me here, meaning in Egypt. So Jacob says, well, bring them over here that I may bless them. I mean, this is kind of like you have this formality still in church today. For instance, in my church, when parents bring up a child to be baptized, part of the liturgy, the formal words that are said there is the pastor will say, what is this child to be named? Well, the pastor already knows what the child is to be named, but it's just kind of part of the formality of the service. So the parents will say, well, his name is John or Tom or her name is Cindy or whatever. And then the liturgy will continue. That's kind of what's going on here. So Israel says, who are these? Knowing full well who they are. And Joseph says, these are my God-given children. So bring them over here so I can bless them. Now, verse 10, we have kind of an ironic description of Jacob, because it says the eyes of Israel, meaning Jacob, were so dim from age that he could not see. Then Joseph brought them close to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. Now, the reason I say this is ironic, because you'll remember that when Jacob, years ago, received the blessing from his father, he was able to accomplish this because his father's eyes were dim from old age. So just like Jacob received the blessing of the firstborn when his father was barely able to see, so now he, being an old man himself and barely able to see, is about to pronounce a blessing upon the firstborn of his son Joseph. So Joseph brings them over. He kisses and embraces them. And then Israel says this. He says, I never expected to see your face, Joseph. And look, God has let me see your children as well. So it's kind of I guess it's for me anyway, it's a touching scene. Because after all that, I mean, Jake, we've talked so much about Jacob's negative qualities. And for all those, you can't help but at the same time feel some compassion for him after all that he went through, especially after the disappearance of Joseph. So after all that time, he's back with Joseph. He's had almost two decades of good years. And we saw when they got down into Egypt that he thought he was about dead. I mean, he talks about going down to see Joseph before he dies. So he thought this would be the end for him, and yet God granted him 17 more years of happiness with his son. So not only did he think he would never see Joseph's face again, but he never in his wildest imagination dreamed that he would be able to embrace and to kiss his two grandsons, the sons of his favorite son, Joseph. So a moving scene here. Then we have a surprise. So Joseph takes his two sons and he bows his face to the ground before his father to honor them. And Joseph is kind of a stage manager here. You know, he's getting everything ready for the blessing that's about to be pronounced upon his sons. This is a big deal. This isn't just kind of a thing you do. This is a formal, lasting, irrevocable blessing that's about to be pronounced. And so Joseph wants to set everything up for his dad. And so he moves his two sons in front of his father's bed, so that when his father places his right hand on the head of the one son and his left hand on the head of the other son, that he'll get it right, because Manasseh is the firstborn. So he puts him where the right hand of his dad will be, and Ephraim is the secondborn, and so he positions him where the left hand of Jacob will be, because the right hand in the scriptures is the symbol of strength and blessing. So he brings him right to the edge of his father's bed. And then we have the surprise. The old man stretches out his right hand and he puts it on the son who's to his left. And then he stretches out his left hand and he puts it on the son who's to his right. So he crosses his arms and puts his hands on the head of the quote-unquote wrong son. And then he begins to pronounce this blessing. He blesses Joseph, and he says, the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who's been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, and may my name live on in them, in the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now let me come back to that before what we just said, but notice Joseph's reaction, because when Joseph saw what was happening, he realized that his dad, he thought anyway, his dad had messed up, and so he grabs his father's hands and he tries to switch them to the way he thinks they should be. But his father says, look, I know, my son. I know what I'm doing. I haven't lost my mind. I crossed my hands for a reason. He says, the younger, meaning Ephraim, the younger shall become a great people. He shall be greater than his older brother. So the greater blessing is pronounced upon the younger son, and the lesser blessing is pronounced upon the older son. There's a switch, a reversal that takes place as the blessing is pronounced upon Ephraim, and then the lesser blessing is pronounced upon his older brother, Manasseh. Now, the reason I love this is because this fits so perfectly with the biblical model of God reversing our expectations. Now, we've seen this repeatedly throughout the book of Genesis. Already in Genesis 4, God looks favorably upon the sacrifice of Abel, the secondborn, not favorably on the sacrifice of the firstborn, Cain. Once more, in the case of Abraham, it's Ishmael who's the firstborn and Isaac who's the secondborn, but the blessing goes to the secondborn. Same in the case of Jacob and Esau. Esau is the firstborn, but Jacob, the secondborn, receives the blessing. And so now, once more, we have the blessing going to the one who was born later in time and not to the one who's born prior. Now, this has fantastic theological implications. If you look at what God is doing throughout all of these reversals throughout the book of Genesis, if you look at those from the perspective of the complete biblical narrative, it helps understand how Christ, as the second Adam, as Adam who's born later in time, is the one who receives the blessing of the Father, and through whom the blessing then comes to us who are of his body. So it's not the firstborn Adam, it's the secondborn Adam. It's not the first, but it's the one who comes later in time, who is the source, who's the recipient of blessing and the source of blessing for us. So you can see in these reversals that take place through Genesis a preview of how God is going to do his greatest work in giving to us the true blessing of our inheritance and the true blessing of being part of his family by means of the Adam that's born later in time and through whom the blessing comes to us.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that kind of perspective, I think, when you pull together Genesis with the salvation that we have in Christ, it helps to infuse all of these various stories, beginning with Cain and Abel, and all the way now through Benjamin, and I mean through Ephraim and Manasseh, with a deeper meaning. It shows there's this consistency in how God is at work from the beginning to do the exact opposite of what we expect, and the result of that is that we are drawn into the blessing through this second born, the one born later in time.
Adoption and blessing on another's deathbed. There's theological implications in there.
Yeah, this whole chapter is rich with them. I wish we need about 80 minutes, I think, to unpack all of this, but we'll have to leave it at that.
All right. Well, that's it. We're out of time. So next week, we will try to wrap it up, Chad.
We will. 49. We'll look at the blessing of the rest of the sons, and then we'll wrap up with the final chapter, 50.
All right.
So stay tuned.
All right. Well, guys, hey, coming up in just a little over 2 weeks, from the time this airs, we're going to be in Dallas. We're going to be talking about parables. Lots of stories there. We've been going through a lot of stories here. We're going to go through some New Testament stories in Dallas. I'll be there. Chad will be there. Lise Fitzpatrick, Scott Keith, Daniel Van Vores, Donovan Riley. It's going to be a good time. You can go over to ChristToldFast.org and check out the events page there, and you can see it. You can register. So if you're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, or if you want to drive to that area and come hang out with us for a day, do it. We'd love to see you, and we'll get to hang out. Also, hey, if you enjoy this, if you enjoy the work that Christ Told Fast does, we really could use your support. So you can go over to ChristToldFast.org and go to the support page, and you can make a donation there. You can do a one-time donation or a reoccurring donation, and that really does help us offset all the time and expenses it takes to do all the things that that we do. And we do appreciate those of you who find this worth investing in. So that being said, we will see you guys next week.